In summer 1914, the world went to war. Now, 110 years later, we go back to those figures, to those debates, to those questions in the greatest failure in the history of diplomacy. I am Dr. Zach Twomley. You're listening to When Diplomacy Fails, and this is the July Crisis. Our old dilemma with every Austrian Balkan action. If we encourage them, they will say we have pushed them into it. If we advise against it, it will be said that we have left them in the lurch and we will lose the last middling ally. Kurt Riesler, personal secretary to the German Chancellor, 7th of July 1914. When Count Alexander Hoyos got the late train to Berlin on Saturday the 4th of July, he could not have known that his mission to acquire German support for a decisive showdown with Serbia would later be identified as among the most controversial aspects of the July crisis. Emerging from Berlin with what became known to posterity as the blank check, Hoyos's mission would later be heavily scrutinized. Was this the signal that Germany intended to fight a world war? Was it proof of German plans for a preemptive strike before conditions became unfavourable? Or was it merely a formality given to a beleaguered ally which had already determined on its warlike course? As we will see shortly in our analysis, those Germans who advised the Austrians to move emphasised the importance of speed, both to capitalise on the lingering shock at the Archduke's assassination and to prevent Russian intervention. The comforting view, though by no means shared by everyone in Berlin at the time, was buttressed by the idea that the Tsar would not fight, as it would mean giving sanction to the regime of regicides in Belgrade. This naivety, as it seems to us now, was clearly not held by everyone. We have seen the extent of Austro-German military plans, and the great angst held by Konrad, the Habsburg chief of staff, who repeatedly interrogated his German counterpart as to the scope and substance of German military support in the East. Planning for all eventualities was the duty of the military personnel, now leading Vienna towards the abyss, but it is important to point out that even if Russia had publicly declared its intention to intervene from the beginning, there's no guarantee that matters would have proceeded differently. How much responsibility should be placed at the feet of Vienna or Berlin for failing to grasp the concerns of the Tsar's ministers, who could no more allow its Serb ally to be crushed than Austria could allow the Serb insult to go unanswered? If Russian support for Serbia was inevitable, how equally unstoppable was the Austrian strike against Serbia? Two key questions may be identified in the blank check controversy. First, was German support for Austria the key ingredient, or was Austria determined, regardless of the answer, to make war against Serbia? According to the Fritz Fischer thesis, Germany persuaded Austria to make war, yet this has since been heavily scrutinized. As Samuel Williamson Jr. clarified, we should be careful not to take the agency away from Vienna. Williamson wrote, "The German blank check gave Vienna the assurance it needed to opt for decisive action against Serbia. Berchtold hoped that early and decisive support would deter Russian intervention. A firm German declaration might keep the war local. If the action were not localized, the Austro-Hungarian flank with Russia would be protected. From Berlin's standpoint, it had agreed to Vienna's request. But the initiative had been Vienna's, not Berlin's. The steps that pushed Europe towards war were taken in Vienna. The support given by Berlin simply confirmed and assured that the Habsburg decision to settle accounts would this time be a military solution rather than a diplomatic one." The second question coming from the blank check follows on from this. Did Austro-German solidarity against Serbia signify an intention to launch a wider European war? Or did contemporaries proceed based on the risk that Russia would not get involved, localizing any conflict to the Balkans, as the recent Balkan Wars had been? To put it another way, was Vienna searching for a world war or merely a third Balkan War? In this episode, with an examination of the documents, we'll hopefully be able to clarify these two questions, and you can decide for yourself where the matters stand. First, we have to go to Vienna. On the 5th of July 1914, Emperor Franz Josef finally met his chief of staff in person. In this account the chief of staff provided in the mid-1920s, Konrad began by stressing his views on the inevitability and unavoidability of war with Serbia. Franz Josef: "Yes, this is quite right, but how do you want to wage war if then everyone will attack us, particularly Russia?" Konrad: "But Germany will cover our rear." His Majesty looked at me doubtfully and said, "Are you certain of Germany?" He had charged the heir to the throne, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, to demand of the German Kaiser a declaration whether we could in the future count unconditionally on Germany. The German Kaiser had avoided the question and not given an answer. Konrad: "But Your Majesty, we must know how we are placed." Franz Josef: "Yesterday evening, a note has been dispatched to Germany in which we demand a clear answer." Konrad: "If the answer is that Germany is on our side, will we then wage the war against Serbia?" Franz Josef: "In that case, yes." After a brief pause contemplating this question, His Majesty continued, "But if Germany does not give us that answer, what then?" Konrad: "Then we are indeed on our own. We would need the answer soon, as the big decision depends upon it." Franz Josef: "The German Kaiser is on his North Sea cruise. In any case, we will have to await the answer." "I was under the impression that His Majesty was not certain of Germany, and therefore hesitated in his decision." As we've seen in the previous episode, neither the Emperor, nor his Chief of Staff, nor the Foreign Minister were entirely sure where Germany stood with regard to an Austrian war against Serbia. Years of crises, Balkan wars, trial mobilizations and other confrontations, the development of an effective Anglo-German diplomacy, and the contradictory statements of German Ambassador Chertsky had muddied the waters on this vital question. Yet, as the Emperor noted above, Vienna was about to demand a clear answer. What he did not mention was that this note was dispatched alongside the Foreign Minister's own personal messenger. Indeed, at this very moment, Berchtold's Chief of Staff, Count Alexander Hoyos, was in Berlin, liaising with the Austrian ambassador there and arranging several meetings with the Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg, the Kaiser and Arthur Zimmermann, the Undersecretary of the German Foreign Office. It's now necessary to look at these two separate accounts, one from Hoyos and one from Ambassador Zogyny, spread over 2 days. Count Hoyos recorded the following of his meeting with Arthur Zimmermann on the 5th of July, writing: "The conversation which then developed and which lasted over an hour could only be interpreted by me that, in Berlin, they expected an energetic strike by us against Serbia and that they were determined to grant us the necessary support. Zimmermann said much about the readiness for battle of the German army, its strength since the acceptance of the last army bill. Among other things, he remarked that we would probably be sufficiently occupied in the Balkans and hardly be able to muster significant numbers of troops against Russia. But this did not matter, for Germany was strong enough to wage the war on both fronts alone. On parting, I said to Zimmermann, 'You could not really have thought that Austria-Hungary would quietly accept the murder of the heir to the throne at Sarajevo and not react to it.' He replied, 'No, but we did fear it a little bit.'" This was an informal, almost casual, conversation between two high-ranking diplomatic chiefs, notwithstanding the subject matter or its implications. We should note the German confidence in its ability to fight a two-front war if it came to that, although, for the record, Konrad would later scoff at Zimmermann's claims in this regard, suggesting that the German Undersecretary at the Foreign Office didn't quite know what he was saying. The following day, on the 6th of July, Hoyos had a more formal meeting with Bethmann Hollweg, Gottlieb von Jago, the German Secretary of State, and Zimmermann again being present. "But even here," Hoyos remarked, there was no sense of the German gentleman wanting to restrain us or to limit the action to the realm of diplomacy. And Hoyos continued. In reply to the question what we intended to do with Serbia when we had carried out the action, I took the liberty much resented by Tisza to declare that Serbia would have to be divided between us, Bulgaria and Romania. I did this because I knew that the Germans would waver in the support of our plans if, as had been the case in the Balkan War and in the following years, we could not formulate our plans precisely and had uncertain aims. This indeed was one of the requirements that the German ambassador, Chertsky, had presented in his meetings with Austrian officials and through his use of journalistic intermediaries. Of course, as Hoyos noted, the act of annexing Serb territory, taking in more Slavs, and diluting the Hungarian demographic percentage was bound to meet Tisza's opposition. Yet Hoyos evidently believed it was more important to present the germ of a plan to its German ally than to placate the Hungarian minister-president. In any case, Stefan Tisza seemed so opposed to war with Serbia in all its forms that violating this demand was unlikely to alter this stance. Hoyos recounted the exchanges as they continued. My conversation with the three German statesmen ended with me repeating to the Chancellor that we considered a war with Serbia unavoidable sooner or later, but that we were willing for now to make do with closer ties with Bulgaria if Germany felt that a different moment would be more advantageous from a European point of view. In reply, Bethmann Hollweg told me that it was not for Germany to give us advice regarding our policy vis-à-vis Serbia, that she would cover our back and fulfil her alliance obligations in every way if we considered it necessary to proceed against Serbia. If I wanted to know his personal view about the opportunity afforded by the present moment, then he could tell me that war was unavoidable and the current point in time was more advantageous than a later one. We might be surprised at the spectacle of the hawk, Hoyos, withdrawing from the precipice somewhat and meekly suggesting that Austria didn't have to make war on Serbia now if it was inconvenient to Germany. That Hoyos claimed Vienna would satisfy itself with the Bulgarian alliance was very far from how Berchtold felt, and as his chief of staff, Hoyos was aware of this. The desire to sound out German positions was fulfilled with this tentative step, and when it became obvious that the German Chancellor was not prepared either to restrain Austria or instruct her, it became easier for Hoyos to ask for what he truly wanted, unconditional German support. Hoyos went further, following up this exchange by insisting Italy should be left in the dark about Austro-German intentions, lest she blow the whistle on the plot or demand compensation from her allies. The German statesman present agreed, and that very day Zimmermann appears to have told a barefaced lie to the Italian ambassador in Berlin, who wrote to Rome regarding the reassurance given to me by Zimmermann that he would try to influence the Vienna cabinet towards moderation. Thus, as complicated as the narrative becomes, owing to such a long list of characters, what they knew and who they spoke to, we should also be aware of those scenarios where straightforward deceit and straight-up lies were just used instead. Zimmermann may have claimed that the importance of the moment required such deception. That Bethmann Hollweg viewed war as inevitable certainly suggests Germany was preparing for a European war. Yet, if the war the German Chancellor referred to in Hoyos's above account meant instead an Austro-Serb war, the tone of the account appears very different. The German emphasis on immediately seizing the moment is nonetheless clear, and it is an understated fact of the July crisis just how sorely Berlin would be let down by Vienna in this regard. Hoyos's teammate, Ambassador Zogeny, had also had a busy day on the 5th of July. His account of meeting with the Kaiser after giving him the Mecheko Memorandum and Franz Josef's personal letter ran as follows. The first thing that he, Wilhelm II, assured me was that he had expected some serious step on our part towards Serbia, but at the same time he must confess that the detailed statement of His Majesty, Franz Josef, made him regard a serious European complication possible, and that he could give no definite answer before having taken counsel with the Imperial Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg. After lunch, when I again called attention to the seriousness of the situation, the Kaiser authorized me to inform our gracious Majesty that we might in this case, as in all others, rely upon Germany's full support. Wilhelm reiterated the importance of checking with Bethmann Hollweg before he gave any unconditional guarantee, an indication, perhaps, that the Kaiser's mood had softened since the days immediately following the assassination. Yet Wilhelm did reassure Zogeny that the Chancellor would see eye to eye with him on this question. Above all, Wilhelm impressed upon the Austrian ambassador the importance of acting now, quickly and decisively, before Russia could act in turn, as the conversation continued. It was his, Wilhelm's, opinion that this action must not be delayed. Russia's attitude would in any case be hostile, but for this he had been prepared for years, and even if a war between Austria-Hungary and Russia were to result, we could be convinced that Germany would stand by our side with the usual faithfulness of an ally. Russia was, by the way, at the present time not prepared for war, and would certainly think very hard before appealing to arms. But it would agitate against us among the Triple Entente and add fuel to the fire in the Balkans. He understood perfectly well that his Apostolic Majesty, Franz Josef, given his well-known love of peace, would find it very difficult to march into Serbia, but if we had really recognised the necessity of warlike action against Serbia, then he, Wilhelm, would regret it if we did not make use of the present moment, which was so favourable to us. Zogeny's account continues with the Kaiser dismissing the utility of a Bulgarian alliance. He did not have any trust in King Ferdinand, Zogeny recorded. Yet Wilhelm would not object to the inclusion of Bulgaria, provided Romania was not excluded. The next day, Zogeny sent his second account to Vienna concerning the events of the 6th of July, where Bethmann Hollweg, Zimmermann and Hoyos were present. The Kaiser had by now headed off on his North Sea cruise. The conversation began with the Chancellor running through the options for Romania and Bulgaria. Both were to be calmed and pressured by Germany in equal measure, and told that on this occasion, Vienna was compelled to act against Serbia. Zogeny continued, "As regard our relations with Serbia, the German government is of the opinion that we may judge what is to be done to clarify the relationship. In this we could, whatever form our decision might take, certainly count on Germany as ally and friend of the monarchy to be right behind her. During the further course of conversation, I ascertained that the Imperial Chancellor, like his Imperial Master, considers immediate intervention on our part as the radical and best solution for our difficulties on the Balkans. From an international point of view, he considers the present moment as more favourable than a later one." We should note that amidst these plans for a diplomatic approach to Romania and Bulgaria, German officials appeared determined to support Austria in whatever course she took. This was the essence of the blank check, and it was clearly expressed in both Hoyos's and Zogeny's accounts. Yet it is somewhat surprising to see these German officials recommending war with Serbia rather than insisting upon it. Vienna was told that now was the best moment to strike, that Russian intervention was unlikely, but that if the Tsar did intervene, the Germans would again stand by her ally come what may. It is important to note that Berlin did not here force her partner into a European war. What German officials did do was take the calculated risk that Austria could have her Serbian war without Russian intervention. If Germany's blank check is the main story of these meetings, the secondary story was the impression that Russia would allow its Serbian ally to be crushed without becoming involved. As William Mulligan wrote, "Bethmann Hollweg calculated that whereas an attack, sponsored by institutions within Serbia, on the Habsburg monarchy would be considered a vital interest to Austria-Hungary, a punitive war undertaken by Austria-Hungary against Serbia would not be considered a vital interest to Russia. The asymmetry of interests, coupled with the risks of war, would restrain Russia. The blank check, therefore, was issued on the assumption that a war between Austria-Hungary and Serbia could probably be localised." This is an important distinction, although it doesn't make the story any less complex. Another factor to consider aside from Russia were the Habsburg policymakers themselves. Despite coming to Berlin, documents in hand, and spouting much more forceful language than was used before, a certain habit had developed in German official circles which continued to view Vienna as the dog which would bark, yet refused to bite. This may surprise us, given how much weight is attributed to the blank check, yet there remained Germans who could not imagine Austria-Hungary taking such a step after several years of false starts and bluffing. Indeed, the German Minister of War, Erich von Falkenhayn, wrote to Moltke saying as much on the 5th of July. Falkenhayn was not present for the audience given to Hoyos or Zogeny, and he discerned from the two documents the glaring omission of any mention of war. This, to Falkenhayn, suggested that war was not in the offing, and that the crisis would instead blow over as all the others had. Falkenhayn wrote to Moltke, the German chief of the general staff, as follows. Insofar as the hurriedness of the proceedings gave one a chance to arrive at any opinion, these documents did not succeed in convincing me that the Vienna government had taken any firm resolution. Both paint a very gloomy picture of the general situation of the dual monarchy as a result of pan-Slav agitations. Both consider it necessary that something should be done about this with the greatest urgency. But neither speaks of the need for war. Rather, both expound energetic political action, such as the conclusion of a treaty with Bulgaria, for which they would like to be certain of the support of the German Reich. This support should be granted with some indication that it would, in the first place, be a matter for Austria-Hungary to take the requisite steps which are in her own interest. The German Minister of War was thus so convinced of Habsburg timidity by what he had read that he recommended Vienna cease beating about the bush and engage with the war that was in her interests to pursue. More interesting still than these observations, occurring just as the Germans were being asked to guarantee their support of Austrian actions, was the attitude of the Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg. According to the Minister of War Falkenhayn, "The Chancellor appears to have as little faith as I do that the Austrian government is really in earnest, even though its language is undeniably more resolute than in the past. At any rate, not only has he raised no objections about the Kaiser's North Sea cruise taking place, but he has even recommended it. Certainly under no circumstances will the coming weeks bring any decisions. It will be a long time before the treaty with Bulgaria is concluded." Falkenhayn finished his telegram by assuring Moltke that he could continue convalescing on his holiday and would not have to return to Berlin since there was nothing to be done at the current moment. That Bethmann Hollweg was happy to wave the Kaiser off on his cruise, where Wilhelm would be out of reach and away from the decision-making heart of Germany for the next few weeks, has been interpreted in several ways. Was this the German Chancellor attempting to maintain the facade that it was business as usual, deceiving the other powers into the belief that nothing suspicious was afoot? Was Bethmann Hollweg trying to get the Kaiser out of the way so Wilhelm could not interfere to beef up or tone down any assurances Berlin gave to its ally? In fact, at this time, Bethmann Hollweg also returned to his country estate in Hohenfinau for a brief vacation. So if these excursions were all part of the same interconnected plot to deceive contemporaries, it was certainly well coordinated. Or, taking Occam's razor as our guide, perhaps these officials and the Kaiser truly did believe that nothing would come from the weighted commitment they had just given to Austria. If we are to judge what Falkenhayn observed from the atmosphere in Berlin by this point, there seems to have been a sense of disbelief that Vienna would do anything confrontational. The idea that Vienna would have been content with a mere Bulgarian treaty as compensation for the slain Archduke may strike us as ludicrous given what followed, but we should recall Hoyos's account given above, wherein it was suggested that Vienna might satisfy itself with the Bulgarian treaty if Germany preferred it. This impression was apparently echoed among some segments of the German Navy. On the 6th of July 1914, Albert Hauptmann, a senior German naval officer, wrote to Tirpitz, the head of the Admiralty, in the following striking terms. "The Austrian government would approach Serbia with demands for the most extensive satisfaction, and as soon as this had not been fulfilled, to have her troops march into Serbia. His Majesty does not consider it likely that Russia would intervene, because the Tsar would not support regicides, and because Russia was currently not entirely ready for war, militarily and financially. The same was true, particularly in financial regards, in France. His Majesty did not speak about England. he let it be known to Kaiser Franz Joseph that he could rely on him. His Majesty believes that the situation will be clarified in 8 days' time with Serbia giving in, but nonetheless considers it necessary also to be prepared for a different outcome. The idea that within 8 days Serbia would be sorted out was of course a dramatic misreading of events, yet within this is the Kaiser's belief that Austria would move quickly and an expectation that the confrontation would then blow over. The two impressions are thus connected because by moving quickly, not only would Austria acquire its satisfaction, but Russia would be excluded from the calculations. In the event Russia did intervene, though, Germany would be prepared. By the 9th of July, Hoffmann seemed even more convinced of these impressions, writing again to Tirpitz. The German Foreign Office, Hoffmann said, does not consider the situation to be very threatening, and Hoffmann added, personally, I am convinced that the Austrians were never quite as fired up as His Majesty has portrayed it, and that they have already lost steam and are still losing it. I would also consider it not very advantageous if we were to associate, come what may, with their business, which is more or less leaning towards bankruptcy. England will have the last laugh. Officer Hoffmann was not sugarcoating the situation. That day on the 9th of July, several days having passed since Hoyos had returned to Vienna, the head of the Bavarian legation in Berlin wrote to the Bavarian Prime Minister in Munich regarding both the lack of confidence in Austria and the sense of calm which seemed to have enveloped the German Foreign Office. The Bavarian wrote, Under Secretary of State Zimmermann would consider the current point in time for Austria as very favourable for, as he put it, launching a war of revenge against the southern neighbour, and he believes firmly that it would be possible to localise the war. But he doubts that one would decide on this in Vienna. From Berlin's side, one would not dissuade the Viennese government from proceeding with all means against Serbia, rather to let know that Austria, come what may, will see her ally by her side. Vis-à-vis the representatives of the other major powers, the German Foreign Office emphasised that it regards the situation without any nervousness, and as evidence has pointed to the fact that, otherwise, His Majesty the Kaiser would have refrained from starting on his North Sea cruise, and the Chancellor would not have gone to Hohenfinau, the Chief of Staff, not gone on holiday. Germany's federal constitution entailed the operation of these separate regional functionaries, like that of Bavaria, who held similar titles to those in Berlin, but crucially lacked any of the political stopping power of, say, a Stefan Tisa in Vienna. Still, these observations from this Bavarian official echo those of a Saxon quoted in a previous episode, and give an impression of Austrian timidity and Russian passivity, which contributed to an overall sense of calm. What is striking is that the Germans were far from the only ones to view the crisis in this light. Even the French ambassador to Vienna, writing on the 10th of July to his premier in Paris, wrote extensively on the tone of the Austrian press and a sense of fatalistic defiance therein. Yet the ambassador nonetheless came to the following conclusion. To recap, behind these exaggerations is probably hidden desire not to continue in the direction to which they were committed. The Emperor, it is claimed, has shown himself to be opposed to it. Furthermore, I recall that the inquiry did not provide the accurate results that were expected and which would have allowed Serbia to be clearly accused of abominable complicity. It will, as ever, make a great deal of noise to no effect, which will satisfy Austria's vanity with the thought that the Serbians will have been very alarmed by it. Once more, we see the cliché reinforced by recent years of confrontation and intimidation that Austria would bark, perhaps barking now louder than she had ever barked before, but she wouldn't bite. These impressions proved disastrously false, but that they existed at all among informed Germans, uninformed Germans, and diplomatic personnel from other countries reminds us of Christopher Clark's conception of sleepwalkers. Were these contemporaries blindly walking towards disaster, misled by the assumptions that the July crisis would transpire just as anticlimactically as every other crisis so far? It is certainly worth questioning whether it was above the imagination of contemporaries to believe that this time, for real this time, war would follow the assassination, an assassination which by the 10th of July had largely vanished from the European press, and certainly from the minds of much of the European public. In Berlin, there seemed two possible scenarios. The first, interpreted as the most likely, was that Russia would not intervene, and Austria would be permitted to resolve its dispute with Serbia. The second, perceived as less probable, was that Russia would deny the legitimacy of Austria's grievances, ignore the fact that their own military preparations were incomplete, and provoke a European war. Importantly, the vaunted statements of German officials that it was better to have war now, if it came, applied to this second scenario. In the unlikely event, unlikely as it seemed to Berlin, that Russia did become involved, it was better to fight this war now rather than later, when Russia was markedly more powerful and organised. As Christopher Clark discerns, the German impressions of Russian passivity in this case was based on past experiences of her diplomatic weaknesses, such as in October 1913, when the Tsar accepted Austria's ultimatum to Serbia to refrain from acquiring an Adriatic port. But they were also reinforced by the belief that it behooved Russia to wait for a more advantageous moment. For the moment, Russia gave the Kaiser no cause for anxiety, Ambassador Zadzhny recorded in October 1913 in the aftermath of Russia's retreat. For the next 6 years, one need fear nothing from that quarter. Wedded to these assumptions was the notion that the Tsar would never associate himself with a regicidal regime in Belgrade, considering his own domestic woes and the memory of his grandfather's assassination by such regicides. We should also note that neither Vienna nor Berlin had all the necessary information. By now, Clark notes, the Balkans had been factored into the Franco-Russian alliance. Changes in personnel in Russia's Council of Ministers and the impact this would have on Russia's foreign policy were also not fully appreciated or understood. Finally, recent experiences of détente and effective peacemaking caused contemporaries to underrate the danger of their actions. Peace had been preserved once. Who could imagine it would fail on this occasion, in 1914, when calmer heads appeared to be in the ascendant? There was also a sense that by pursuing satisfaction for the assassination, it would be possible to get a clearer impression of where Russia stood. Strategically, if Russia did act against Austria, Germany had her answer and enjoyed better prospects for success than she would if a similar crisis occurred in 1916 or beyond. These calculations were made in the knowledge that a risk was being taken. Yet it is important to play devil's advocate here. What would have happened if Germany refused to play Russia's game and backed down if the Tsar did decide to fight for Serbia? As Christopher Clark noted, this was not much of a choice at all. Germany faced the prospect of losing its one remaining ally and of coming under steadily increasing pressure from the Entente states, whose ability to enforce their preferences would increase as the balance of power tilted irreversibly away from Germany and whatever remained of Austria-Hungary. Contemporary articles highlighting the growing power of Russia, extensive French loans, railway improvements, and language suggesting a war of extermination pitting German against Slav could only have added to the sense of encirclement in Berlin. This factor is regularly highlighted in German-centric views of the war's origins, but we should not forget that the Germans were right to be concerned. From 1913 to 14, Russian naval expenditure surpassed Germany's for the first time. Worse, German spies had informed their government of secret Anglo-Russian naval talks, featuring a division of naval theatres and even a scheme to land British troops in Pomerania, and when the British continued to deny these steps, this only confirmed that something nefarious was going on. This crisis in Anglo-German trust could not have come at a worse time for Bethmann Hollweg, whose desire to improve relations with London had been a touchstone of his policy, and who assumed Britain would never support an Entente war with the Triple Alliance. Those accounts which hold Germany responsible for the war tend to dismiss the legitimacy of her fears of encirclement, but these beliefs were sincerely held, as sincerely as those which predicted Russia remaining uninvolved. One is drawn to a diary entry of Bethmann Hollweg's private secretary, Kurt Riesler, who captured the gloom of the moment on the 7th of July, while at Hohenfinnau, the Chancellor's summer residence 60 kilometres from Berlin. Riesler wrote, "In the evening on the veranda, under the night sky, long conversation about the situation, the secret talks which he, Bethmann Hollweg, tells me, gives a devastating impression. He considers the Anglo-Russian negotiations about a naval convention, the landing in Pomerania, as very serious, the last piece in the chain. Lichnowsky, much too blue-eyed, was being duped by the English. Russia's military power increasing fast. If strategic expansion on Poland, the situation can be held in check. Austria increasingly weaker and immobile, the burrowing from the north and southeast very much advanced. In any case, unable to go to war as our ally for a German cause, the Entente knows that we are entirely paralysed as a result. I am very startled. I had not considered the situation so gravely. One does not hear the secret news if one does not belong properly to the initiated ones. And everything that is high politics and moreover military is top secret. The Chancellor speaks of difficult decisions. Murder of Franz Ferdinand. Official Serbia involved. Austria wants to pull herself together. Message from Franz Josef to the Kaiser with a query regarding the activation of the dual alliance. This time it is worse than in 1912, as this time Austria is on the defensive against Serbian-Russian machinations. An action against Serbia can lead to a world war. The future belongs to Russia, which grows and grows and lies upon us like an ever-present nightmare." As Riesler said, the Chancellor recognised that an attack on Serbia can lead to a world war, but what was the alternative? Support for Austria was the only way of defeating this nightmare, beating back this encirclement, and defending its allies' interests against an incessantly conspiratorial regime in Belgrade. Just because Germany did not intend to launch world war does not mean the ingredients were absent for a disastrous strategic scenario. If the détente with Britain was in doubt, who would restrain the Entente, and could Berlin even depend on Austria? It's important to underline sincere German fears about the long-term viability of the Habsburg Empire, which Riesler touched on above. These concerns were present before the archducal couple had been murdered. As the German ambassador to Britain, Lichnowsky, wrote to Gottlieb von Jagow, the German foreign minister, in late May 1914, saying, "How often do I consider whether it is really worthwhile for us to bind ourselves so tightly to this entity which is falling apart at the seams, and to continue the burdensome effort of dragging it along with us? But I do not yet see any other political constellation which, as a substitute, could offer us anything more than the alliance with this central European power. For without this alliance, our policy would of necessity have to be directed towards a partition of the monarchy." Similar sentiments animated officials in Vienna. These impressions were shared across Europe, as the Austrian Consul General in Warsaw exclaimed, "Before the murder of the Archduke and also after the murder, there prevailed, under the impression of our weak behaviour during the Balkan War, deep depression among our military leaders and in the diplomatic milieu surrounding the Foreign Minister. We are heading for collapse and partition and do not defend ourselves. After Turkey comes Austria. That is the catchword in Eastern Europe." Impressions of Austria-Hungary as the second sick man of Europe were thus known in Vienna. Habsburg officials knew that this was their only opportunity to reverse years of perceived and actual decline, and, as Kurt Riesler put it, pull themselves together. On the 8th of July, the German Chancellor's secretary Kurt Riesler wrote of the situation, "If war comes from the east so that we have to go to war for Austria-Hungary and not Austria-Hungary for us, then we have a chance of winning it. If war does not come, if the Tsar does not want it or concerned France counsels peace, then we still have the chance to break the Entente apart over this." Nonetheless, we should focus a little more closely on the German Chancellor. He may not have wanted a world war, but even the fact that he approved the blank check to Vienna after several years urging restraint upon her does require further consideration. In his article, Examining the Illusion of Limited War in 1914, Konrad Jarauch captured this pressing question. Why did Bethmann Hollweg depart so suddenly and fundamentally from his earlier policy of restraint towards Austria during the Balkan Wars? The official documents contain no clue to his motivation. Conscious of Berchtold's desire for local war, the Chancellor gave more than a blank check. Prodded by Wilhelm, Hoyos, and Zimmermann, and encouraged by the generals, Bethmann Hollweg formulated a coherent rationale, calling for a diplomatic offensive on the Balkans, in which the Austrian punishment of Serbia would be just one part. It is not enough to say that the German Chancellor gambled in approving the blank check to Austrian policy. We must also ask why this inherently cautious minister decided to gamble in the first place. And this question is answered by the context we have outlined in this and previous episodes. And there's also more such background episodes to come, by the way, so keep your eyes peeled for those. Anyway, this sense was widespread among German officials. Berlin had no other choice than to support Vienna's quest for satisfaction, lest Germany lose its only ally. The terms of this gamble entailed a swift strike, a fait accompli which could be achieved before Russia or any other power got involved. As Jarauch continued, Bethmann did not gamble frivolously, but because he considered our position desperate, hoping only, if war comes and the veils fall, the whole nation will follow, driven by necessity and peril. His secretary Riesler longed for victory is liberation, since he was too young not to succumb to the lure of the new, the great movement. But for Bethmann Hollweg, this action is a leap in the dark and as such the most serious duty. While the Pan-Germans were jubilant, the army, navy and colonial leagues ecstatic, and the students feverish with misguided idealism, the aging Chancellor entered on the uncertain course with great reluctance. In the days after the blank check had been given, the mood in Berlin deteriorated further. Yet this sense of gloom did not activate plans for a preemptive war directed by Germany against its rivals. The Kaiser stayed with his crews. Bethmann Hollweg remained in his summer retreat. Moltke continued to convalesce. This behaviour was not representative of a political body gearing up for world war. Germany's subsequent efforts to shield Austria and ensure the plan against Serbia proceeded should also be viewed in this light. When the German foreign minister, Gottlieb von Jago, returned from his honeymoon, he didn't hesitate to speak of his desire for the conflict to be localised. I would have warned the Viennese, whilst acknowledging our alliance obligations, not to let it come to a great war because that entailed too serious a danger for both central powers, Jago later wrote. As Konrad Jarauch observed, Berlin's proddings in Vienna and attempts to shield Austria diplomatically were directed towards a quick punitive strike, but not towards a continental or world war. We may argue that Berlin should have anticipated Austria's difficulties even in this task of swift punitive action, yet even then we must ask what, in the context of 1914, Germany could have done other than support its ally, which had after all just come under attack. We can now conclude on those two questions posed in the beginning of this episode. First, was German support for Austria the key ingredient, or was Austria determined, regardless of the answer, to make war against Serbia? And second, did Austro-German solidarity against Serbia signify an intention to launch a wider European war? I think in each case, the facts are clear. We may debate German intentions. We may point to those discussions of preemptive war, which were so prevalent among the German and Habsburg general staffs. Yet against this, we have to note that the driving force behind the decision for war came from Vienna, and Vienna alone. Further, it is clear that these officials did not believe, or refused to accept, might be the more accurate way to put it, that Russia would become involved, transforming the conflict into a world war. Only when this scenario of world war was reflected upon did contemporary military figures and some statesmen argue that if war was to come, they would be better placed to fight it now, even if they would have preferred to avoid it altogether. As Paul Schrader wrote, "Austria made the original decision on its own and demanded rather than requested German support, and did so in the knowledge that Germany, by denying it, would do unacceptable damage to the alliance and thereby imperil its own position. The question of German responsibility is really a separate one. The initiative for provoking a local war at the risk of a general war came from Vienna and remained there." So the drive for war of any kind came from Austria, from Berchtold, from Conrad, from other statesmen, and even from the Emperor, who recognised that this time things were different. We may condemn these actors for the serious risk they took, and they understood it was a risk, but the limits of available options to acquire the satisfaction from Serbia that they desired seemed to justify this dramatic step. Regarding Germany's role, it may be equally tempting to condemn Berlin for its irresponsible approach to Austria, apparently freeing her from regular restraints. But this was in the context of many years of restraint, to the point that it was feared Austria might seek security outside the Triple Alliance if Berlin neglected to support her once more. Added to this is the important point that what the Germans expected Austria to do, and what Austria did in the end, were two markedly different scenarios. Once the blank check was given, though, there was little Germany could do. Besides, as Kurt Riesler's diary entry of the 11th of July suggests, these difficulties were now outside of Berlin's hands. In Austria, there seemed to be differences as to the method between Berchtold and Tisza, hardly possible to guide their hand from Berlin. They seemed to want a short ultimatum and, if Serbia declines, to march. Apparently they need awfully long to mobilise. 16 days, says Konrad von Hotzendorf. This is very dangerous. A quick fait accompli and then friendly towards the Entente, then the shock can be endured, and hand over any good and overwhelming material against the Serbian machinations, which does not allow any objections. Having given their ally the greatest possible affirmation of support, it was for Germany to wait for Austria's punitive plans to whir into action. Austria had decided upon war with Serbia, and it was up to her to implement these plans into a coherent plan, and as quickly as possible, to capitalise on the shock of the atrocity in Sarajevo and to guard against Russian intervention. Speed and smoothness were essential requirements. Unfortunately for Berlin, and also for the world, fruit ripened maddeningly slowly in Vienna. Berchtold may have possessed the blank check, but he didn't enjoy unanimous support in Vienna. Stefan Tisza, as Kurt Riesler was aware, had different ideas about how to proceed, ideas which were at odds with Berchtold and his colleagues, and which endangered the original plans discussed over the 5th to the 6th of July in Berlin. In the next episode, we'll return to Vienna and see for ourselves how Berchtold tried to navigate the objections of his Hungarian counterpart, objections which, it may be argued, ruined German expectations and played a significant role in facilitating the World War, which neither Vienna nor Berlin wished to fight.